And when people started doing it, when professionals started doing it, they were thought of as being crazy. Yet here we are, 17 years later, and we actually have research foundation now to show us that it's not crazy, that you can do therapy online, you can actually help people, and it's therapeutically beneficial. So there's scientific, there's a ton of studies out there that actually show it's just as helpful as face-to-face therapy. Which brings us to today and the topic of online naked therapy. Obviously we were a little, it seems like a very interesting topic from the title, but it actually has a lot of the same kinds of questions that were raised 17 years ago. Because when I first came across Sarah White's website, I had that first negative impression as a professional, thinking like, how can you do this? I mean, what is she talking about doing online naked therapy? This is insane. But then I realized I was having that same interaction, that same reaction that professionals were having 17 years earlier. So sort of realizing that and getting over my initial skepticism was important for me to get to the point where I thought this was a topic worthy of South by discussion, which is the reason I put together this panel. How technology and things like internet everywhere, mobile devices, and video has now enabled not only traditional therapy online, but opened the door to meld and explore new potentially helpful modalities. And I think that's hopefully what we're going to talk about and have a very interesting discussion today here this morning. So we're going to go down the panel here, and I'm going to ask each person to introduce themselves and talk a little bit about what they're doing online and how they're using the internet for helpful modalities. Sarah?
Hi. Thanks, everyone, for coming this early morning. My name is Sarah White, and I founded my naked therapy practice in October of 2010, so it's relatively young. It started, I was living in New York City and, had moved, having gone to school on the West Coast, and I got a BS in biology, studying psychology. I'd done some modeling out there and was also doing some web development. And I had moved to the city. I knew that online therapy existed, of course. And I was also aware through my work and the web that a lot of people were also talking naked to each other online. And it made sense to me to bring these two things together and to see what they could offer each other, the nakedness and the therapy online. So I founded my practice in 2010, October, and since then I've had hundreds of clients. I've really been able to see this move forward. Oh, I should say, naked therapy is a form of talk therapy during which the client and or the patient gets naked in order to bring about unique and powerful insights. I'm not a licensed therapist. I'm not a psychotherapist. I consider this a new form of therapy that has really come about because of the internet age we live in and the fact that a lot of people are living online or part of their lives online. So that's it.
I'm Julie Hanks, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I've been a clinician for 17 years. And most of my online work is as an adjunct to face-to-face therapy, so using Skype or phone or email with clients that I'm working with face-to-face. And then I also do a lot of psychoeducation. I'm a mental health blogger. I am a social media lover, and so I love to use the internet to educate and advocate for mental health issues. And that's primarily what I do. I own a clinic in Salt Lake City, Utah. And again, I'm Julie Hanks. Happy to be here.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Audrey Jung, and I'm a licensed professional counselor in the state of Arizona. I have been a counselor since 1995, but my foray online actually began a lot earlier than that. And I know a lot of you are probably establishing timelines in your head, thinking, wait, the internet didn't even exist in 1995, so how could you have been an online therapist or been online before that? And that comes from my background. I worked in the deaf community in high school and then studied to actually be a counselor, specializing in the deaf community through undergrad and graduate school. And the deaf community beat the pants off all of us online by using existing technologies to facilitate communication, like the TTY or TDD machines that you used to see on payphones. That was text communication in its purest essence over the phone lines, using massive couples and Ma Bell. And that was the beginning of my understanding of how people could interact personably, support each other, get help from each other online, even if you had to read glowing LCD displays as they came whizzing by in one-line format. So then enter into graduate school in 92, 93, having clinical supervision online because my professors were in one location and they had sent me to Arizona in another location. So that was the beginning of my communication online, and then enter into the foray of being an online therapist, approximately 5 to 7 years after I began my practice as an individual therapist in using cognitive behavior therapy strategies. I just finished a 3-year stint as the president of the International Society for Mental Health Online, an advocacy group, an information group, and I own a clinic in Chandler, Arizona.
Thank you. Thank you all for telling us a little bit about yourselves and you know, what got me interested in Sarah's use of the technology was that she was using the technology in a way to really push the boundaries of what traditional what we think of when we hear what traditional therapy or traditionally helping people is all about. Whether you call it naked therapy or naked coaching or some other term, I don't think is super important. But I'm intrigued by the fact that it was through the actual use of this online video that was readily available that transformed this idea into an actual practice, that a service that other people were willing to pay for. Sarah, I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about, walk us through what a naked therapy session is like and what role you see yourself playing in helping others through this modality.
Well, most naked therapy sessions occur online. So it basically consists of us coming to a common web ground and then henceforth goes what I think you could really think about as a basic talk therapy session. At some point, given what is going on in the session or given what we have discussed prior, either I might start undressing or the client might start undressing. And then often in the end, we'll both be naked and still talking about continuing this conversation that we've started. I think that there are some particular, I think it is obviously not for everybody, but I think that there are some particular cases that this is very helpful for. Just a quick little story. And it's just kind of an obvious example, but did happen. A client who I was seeing who had a lot of anxiety over his penis size. So he had gone through and talked to many traditional therapists, and he had said to them, I think my penis is small. It's making me anxious. It's contracted all the time. I'm just really anxious all the time about this. And then he said to me, but I was never able to show them. So I never really got the relief or the response that I wanted because they couldn't look at me and say, no, it's not, or no, you're fine. No, look, you can use it. So that's good too. That's what's important. And so we were able to do that, and he was able to feel, he started to feel a lot more anxious, more confident in himself. in his penis, in himself, in his life. So that's a pretty simple example. I think there are a lot of motivational issues that can be addressed by naked therapy. Another common topic will be this submission, men who have maybe more submissive desires and wanting to talk about that openly. One other nice little example is a client I had who had told his therapist about 30 years ago that she had a really nice bottom. And the therapist had said to him, that's totally inappropriate. I'm hurt that you said that to me. And he basically spent the next, he was in love with her, and he spent the next like 10, 15 years feeling really bad about this and continuing to see her, but feeling very conflicted because he thought she was hot, but she told him that was wrong to think. And he recently, a couple months ago, sent me an email saying, "Oh my gosh, you look just like her. Is it okay if I tell you that I think you have a nice bottom?" And I said, "Yes, that is okay. That's an okay thing for you to say to me." And he was like, "Oh my God, this is amazing. I've been wanting to say this and I've been feeling bad about this for so long." So I think that, you know, I think that we really address in AK therapy that guys think about sex a lot and they think about, they want to work through these sexual things and want to talk about it in a healthy environment. And in talking with me, they don't need to feel guilty. They don't need to feel stupid for saying that they think about it a lot. And I think that that's because they're allowed to express arousal if they want to, if that's what they're feeling. And if it's not what they're feeling, then that's not what we talk about. And I think there are also different kinds of arousal. So we're talking about sexual, intellectual, emotional arousal. And I think that because of the setup, which is online most of the time, they're really able to feel free to express how they are truly feeling. So yeah, I think that's the ideas.
When we were talking earlier, Audrey, you had mentioned that you made an offhand comment that I think of right now, and that was that in some ways maybe what Sarah is doing is sort of taking out the surrogate in some of traditional like sex or couples therapy, something like that, in the sense that she's kind of combining the two. You know, that there's a potential there, but hearing her talk about some of it too, it just sounds like it's adding another level or something to traditional, what we might look at traditional therapy or something. Yeah.
I kind of hear what you're saying here. I was just making a good note to myself to get back to this. Sarah, you bring up a good point about what I call collateral damage that can sometimes be done in terms of working with a client and instituting the boundaries that we institute as professionals within our client and that professional space. And that's what we were talking about earlier, was that really what you're doing face to face or on your video with the client is not new. It has been techniques that have been used within traditional sex therapy forays in the past, started eons before I was even in high school. However, the difference is that you are the therapist and you're making it okay to talk about these really taboo topics. And one of the things I'd like to see actually in my field is that more therapists make it okay to talk about taboo topics, but don't necessarily have to go to the extreme measures that you're going to with your clients. Mm-hmm. Because I do think that there are a lot of clients, I've seen a lot of men who've wanted to talk about their sex lives and their bodies and their images and their presentation, and want to do this work specifically with females who, you know, even after years and years of experience, may not be comfortable engaging and sustaining in that conversation and have to back out because of their feelings about that, and may, in terms, leave their client with some unresolved grief or shame. Mm-hmm.
Julie, any thoughts?
I agree with what you're saying, and that's come up. I mean, as a female, that sexual transference comes up in therapy a lot, and so I agree that I think we need to get more comfortable with that as professionals. I do think that in terms of being a licensed professional, that I can't ever see naked therapy being embraced by ethically by professionals. But I think the points that you raise, Sarah, in terms of talking about taboo subjects, and really exploring sexuality is something that, as licensed therapists, we could do better.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, is this idea that, I mean, when you're in traditional therapy and you're seeing a therapist face-to-face, there's transference that can occur where you have feelings for the therapist that may mimic feelings that are really for someone else in your life, often a parental figure or whatnot. And therapists know how to deal with those. They're traditionally discussed and can be dealt with properly. But sometimes therapists do have a really sort of automatic, guttural, negative reaction to any kind of discussion about sexuality, especially when it's personified onto the therapist themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that traditional therapy has not done a very good job in the way that it's taught in school doesn't really specifically address that issue. You know, it's just kind of clumped together in the whole transference, you know, bucket. So, yes.
Okay. Well, you know, I just wanted to add, I think that therapists' emerging concerns about liability play in here. And, you know, in American culture, the fear of being pursued legally by doing something important to therapy, or maybe that you didn't realize you had done in therapy, is playing a part here. And you're really pushing the ticket with that, Sarah. But I think that's what has inhibited a lot of professionals for allowing certain content to emerge in therapy, because, you know, there is that, oh, my God, what if they use this against me later, filter.
Yeah. Well, we were just talking last about this idea of, well, should I pursue licensure and traditional psychotherapeutic training and licensure? And it does seem that that's what's inhibiting me from deciding to go that route, although I'm still very much entertaining it. But, I mean, I couldn't do what I do, because then I would, I don't know what happens, but I definitely wouldn't have a license. And it seems like dangerous territory to try to do this potentially in a psychotherapy context. But I guess my question would be, why is that so? I think it's helpful. I personally don't think that it is breaching the code of, I don't know. I guess I don't know the code well enough to really speak on it, but where is it really breaching?
Well, no sexual contact with your clients is a huge...
Right, right. Well, if there's no touch, does it still count? Yeah.
It would be considered exposure.
Exposure. Okay. And also taking advantage of the client-therapist relationship. Hmm. So when you're the therapist, you're in a position of power, you know, or authority. Mm-hmm. And so there's just so much potential for exploitation of your clients when you get into that, into the sexual realm. You know, and my question is, okay, how do we know the work that you're doing is actually therapeutic and not hurting? I work a lot with couples, and the sexual relationship is often an issue, but my goal with those couples is to help them attach sexually and bond with each other, mm-hmm. not with me. Yeah. And so it's a kind of sexual relationship with a client, mm-hmm. and that's, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know that that's actually therapeutic, mm-hmm. and potentially could be extremely damaging.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard because, I guess I know what I do because I do it. I think a lot of the time what I'm talking to clients about is them and how they can reignite their marriage, their relationship with their wife or with a long-term partner. That's often what we're talking about, frankly. Often it's people who can't even approach women. I'm not really seeing men who are in really happy relationships. That's not usually who I'm dealing with.
Because their wives would not be.
Well, not that their wives wouldn't be into it, but they don't need therapy. They don't feel like they need therapy. They're able to talk to their wife perhaps about these things. I think those are good questions, and they are things that I am very much attuned to, and I'm constantly asking myself, and I guess all I can really do right now is hold myself to my own standards, which is that I'm really, my interest is in helping people and helping men It's turned out to be in helping men in particular and to being open and receptive to what men are saying that they want and then trying to help them through that to lead a better life. And I've just had success in it, or I wouldn't continue doing it. I don't have a desire to hurt people, but you're right. There's no one who's supervising me who's saying, yes, this is right, this is wrong. But I think that that's because it's not, who can supervise at this point since it's a new field?
Well, I guess my concern is that, like, who's trained you in therapy with or without clothes on? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. how do we know that what you're doing is actually therapy in the mm-hmm. first place? It could just be talking about feelings while being aroused. And is that necessarily therapy? So, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I'm a lay therapist. I consider myself a lay therapist. I'm definitely not a trained therapist.
A lay therapist.
I know, that was funny.
Yeah. do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it's like
sure.
to call yourself, we're doing talk therapy. It's mm-hmm. like, but you're not trained in talk therapy. Do you know what I mean? So,
I'll just point out that there's a lot of people who do things that are similar to talk therapy.
Coaching.
Coaching is the obvious example.
And there's training for coaching, too, now.
Which is a whole field that has sprouted up in the past 5-10 years that doesn't have the same kinds of safeguards, such as state licensure and whatnot. And licensure, just like for a medical doctor, for a therapist, is meant there to protect the patient, to protect the client from any kind of therapist misconduct or whatnot. But I'm thinking of more subtle examples, such as when you go to your stylist for a haircut or something. And there's a lot of stuff that goes on there that can be very therapeutic. But, of course, the hairstylist does not have a license in therapy. Same when you go and talk to a rabbi or a priest or something. They may not actually be a formal licensed pastoral counselor. But they get and they do a lot of therapy informally. So we do have other examples in society where people are doing things that, technically should be covered by licensure or ethics of the therapy, the psychotherapy profession, but aren't, because society kind of just accepts that, there's different angles and different boundaries.
Well, government is always playing catch up. They're trying to play
Absolutely.
Catch up now with online therapy, and perhaps I see more of what you're talking about doing is counseling versus therapy or versus psychotherapy, and that you're staying on the superficial with the issue that's at hand. And I'm not sure. Maybe you can speak to this, whether you actually get into some of the more deeper content that might be formulating why the client believes that they have the angst that they are having. But I'm just wanting to get back to, I alluded to collateral damage that's happened in therapy, in traditional psychotherapy. I'm wondering if you can foresee any kinds of this similar damage happening with your clients and maybe how you're addressing that.
Well, first of all, yes, we do talk about deeper issues. And that is, informed by my limited experience with an exposure to talk therapy. But yes, we are talking. We're not just talking about what's happening. We're talking about why it's happening. We do talk about family. We do talk about parents. We do talk about history. We do talk about first times. We do talk about dreams and fantasies. And part of the idea is actually that fantasy and their sexual fantasies or just daydreams or fantasies may be a sort of, I like to think, that it tells us quite a lot about this person. That's one idea I'm playing with, that, like, as Freud said, dreams were what tell us about our unconscious, mm-hmm. that I think that our fantasies tell us a lot about our sexuality, which I think also tells us a lot about ourselves. I'm still feeling that out in terms of how people have been responding so far very positively to what I'm doing. I haven't had experiences of... say someone can no longer have sex or something. So I guess I haven't had to approach that yet, and I like to think that as it's coming closer, I'll be able to see it. I can refer out. I can say I think it's time to stop. But I just haven't had that experience yet, so I can't speak to it.
Have you had clients where you did refer them to someone who was a trained psychotherapist?
Yes, I have.
And in what situation have you done that? Do you know what I mean? What was the issue that came up that you thought, oh, this is beyond my
right
scope.
Yeah, so one example, I've done that a few times. One particular example was someone who was sending essentially crazy emails. I would say excessive crazy emails, and I just said, I'm sorry, but I'm not trained to handle what you're going through, so you should contact a licensed therapist.
And have any of your clients revealed to you any sexual abuse that they experienced growing up and how that might be playing out in their content that they seek from you?
That's a good question. Yes, I've had some, but not as much as you would think, honestly. I would honestly think I would have more. But yeah, I've had some. Yeah, should I go into details? Or
yeah, no, that's fine. I think these are all, legitimate concerns that one might have about this form of helping and treatment. Just a little factoid I'd like to throw out there, though, that a lot of people aren't aware of because the history of psychology is both deep and wide. In 1967, there actually was the start of something called nude psychotherapy, which isn't the same as what Sarah does, because there was more of a focus on the nudist aspect and not necessarily arousal or anything like that. But it was a little bit of a phenomena for the time, and it wasn't widely accepted or recognized as something that any majority of therapists did, but it did get written up in the Journal of the American Psychological Association. So it was one of those kind of interesting historic tidbits when I was looking into this topic further that I found out that everything old is new again, especially with the internet, where it can take this idea and kind of turn it on its head and really turn it into something that's, again, potentially interesting to look at from a helping perspective. I kind of want to move on and just talk about more a little bit about we touched upon, Audrey just asked about, if you come across anybody who had to deal with issues of abuse in their life. Sarah, I wonder, in your online work, do you know the person's real name or where they live, or how much do you know about them?
I often do because of credit card processing, essentially. But I don't consider that a prerequisite to the experience of being online. And I think that's because online has added this element of anonymity to our lives, that we can go online and we can be a somewhat different person. And, if you have a couple Facebooks or a couple Twitters or a couple names, lots of people do this online. It's a normal thing. And I think that embracing that, addressing that with, I feel like addressing that with an open heart and saying, yes, it's okay, let's talk about this, let's talk about it if you have a couple identities, let's talk about who you are online, or let's talk about who you are in real life and how these interrelate. So I usually do know, but that isn't necessarily important to me. Obviously, where they're living, their job, their age are all good things to know for helping them. But I try to be really open about how they want to be seen and seeing them in that way, and then trying to help them through that and why, and finding out then why that's how they want to be seen.
Audrey, you do online work, correct? And do you do it with people who you've never seen face-to-face?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And do you also, do you know their name and where they live and things like that?
I do have a registration process, and I do ask that all the clients give me a name, contact information, address. Of course, it's backed up by the credit card, but that might not necessarily be theirs. What I don't do is any legwork before the session begins to actually verify that this person is who they claim to be. Although I probably do have contemporaries out there who might encourage me to do so. I do ask in the intake process that we do field out some issues related to, mental health to determine whether or not there's a crisis at hand. Is this client potentially suicidal? Do I need to have any emergency contact information, including an understanding of how to locate the police in their area? Or maybe I might not take on clients to that extreme.
Gotcha. And Julie?
Yeah, I always want to have their contact information. But again, as you're talking, it just occurred to me, I don't check the names or addresses of the clients I see face-to-face, so they could write down something that wasn't accurate. But I feel professionally that I need to at least have made that attempt in order to protect them if they were going to hurt themselves or someone else. I mean, that's part of ethical behavior.
And I have to back this up. I don't do that face-to-face either. They come in, they claim they are who they are, they pay their payments, they often give me an address, and sometimes when we go to rebill, that they're not living at that address. That does happen. So, you know, it's a phenomenon, I think, that just touches the field across the board.
It's funny because I come across this time and time again where we hold the internet and what we do online to a different, higher standard than what we do face-to-face and in real life. Mm-hmm. And when I was starting in 95 and getting involved in online therapy through the clinic in 99, we grappled with the same issue. And it always frustrated me to no end that professionals would be like, well, how can you not ask for their name and contact information and stuff online and see them? And I'm like, do you ever like verify any of the information you get from them? As long as they're paying their bills, mm-hmm. you're happy. And if they said that they were George Washington, you believe them, if they had something to back it up. So I do find that a little frustrating from time to time, in just the sense that it's that sense that you come across time and time again. Sarah, I was wondering, do you have like a initial session or something? Like traditional therapists, sort of have what's called an intake session where they learn all about the client and what brings them into the office today. And of course, you have a different sense of what you're doing and everything. I was wondering, do you talk about like their informed consent, their rights in therapy, anything like that?
What I have is an email, which is a session scheduling and agreement email in the internet world. And in that, I ask them about their background, and I tell them basically my just things they need to know to work with me. I don't get into what you would get into if you were going to see a psychotherapist, traditional psychotherapist.
And how about you, Audrey? When you see an online client, do you have them like fill out or sign an informed consent or something?
Well, it really depends on the modality that they're seeking online. And there is a form that they complete that has the terms of agreement on it across the board. However, again, I don't have them notarize their signatures, and I don't ask that we get a signature. It's just that I agree, and then they hit submit, and the form comes to me. That's all I have, really. And then our traditional intake session is traditional. I mean, it's depending, again, on the modality we're dealing with. I'm not going to waste a lot of time if they're paying me by the minute for IM to get into too much, family history of mental health. But, in video therapy, I certainly would be asking that question, has anyone else experienced anxiety in your family the way you're expressing it to me, or have you had any, uncles or cousins or aunts who have been hospitalized? When I'm working with email modality in an encrypted format, I, of course, explain the reason why we're using this nightmare of technology through crypto heaven to ensure their confidentiality, and I will sometimes even back that up with experiences we've had with where people have left their emails up on their monitors, and people who should not have read the content have, and what kind of nightmares can ensue from that, and how mm-hmm. encryption can even help with that. So we will go through kind of the nuances of the modalities online and why we're protecting, taking the steps we're taking to protect confidentiality.
So you just mentioned like encrypted email. So you do other work that online that isn't like video.
I do. I do encrypted email, encrypted chat. Again, I also work with the deaf, and occasionally we'll have deaf online clients, and we'll use actually video phone technology, which is superior to Skype, in my opinion, but because it's the refresh rate is so phenomenal. I mean, there's no herky jerky with movements; it's very fluid. these four really essentially different modalities will all be useful in terms of my work in therapy. And sometimes I use my online presence as an adjunct to what's going on face-to-face. I'll offer IM support to teenagers. I'll offer, email consultations to clients who are traveling, or even a Skype visit to clients who are away on business as well.
How does that text interaction differ from a video interaction? I mean, I think we can all sort of envision, even if we've never done it, you know, a webcam session is going to be very similar to speaking to someone face-to-face. What's it like when you try and do online therapy just through text, through words?
It's very different. If you don't know the client ahead of time, you don't hear their voice in your head, and you don't understand the pattern of phraseology that they use to express their feelings. And so sometimes assumptions are made, and sometimes they're right, and sometimes they're wrong. Sometimes humor translates, sometimes it doesn't. Everybody has their own technique for communicating in text. And so in terms of a modality, as a therapist, you have to be in tune to that and aware of all the different ways language can be used to express emotions. And you have to reflect back to the client, you know, when I hear you say this kind of statement, you might cut and paste it there. This is what I'm taking from it. If I'm off base, let's start here by you explaining so that I don't go completely off on a tangent and tell you how to lead your life.
And just one last thing on this same topic. You had mentioned IM and IMing clients that you have a relationship with. I assume that's done through like a phone, right?
Well, nowadays it can be done through a phone. Back in the day of IMing, it was done like, you know, on ICQ and Yahoo.
Do you ever do Twitter or something, like a direct message through Twitter?
I'm not fond of Twitter. Twitter's a great marketing modality, but I'm not fond of it for therapy.
So do you have I asked about informed consent. Do you have like something like a social media policy or something that you give to them?
That's something in the works right now.
Okay, great. Because I think that's such a valuable...
I have one on my website just for face-to-face clients.
Yep. And can you talk a little bit about that? What does that cover? Why is that important?
Well, with licensed mental health professionals, we have to always guard against a dual relationship. And so, you want to make sure that you're protecting them and yourself. And so, you know, basically covers just that they can follow our public, you know, follow our public Facebook pages, but not try to friend their therapist as their profile and get the therapist's specific, you know, personal information and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have a Facebook page, a Facebook profile, and I've actually had a number of clients email me their Facebook profile and say, I want to be friends with you, and will you look at my profile? And it's interesting. I just think that's interesting.
Well, and what do you do?
I look at it. I look at it, and my Facebook profile is essentially my business profile. I don't really mix in much personal things. I'm not friends with people who I was friends with when I was five on there. So I guess in a way I do keep them separate, but it's only one.
So you do friend them?
Yes.
Okay. I thought it'd be interesting to move on and ask the panelists to discuss a recent case or someone that they saw online to sort of share how that a session would go or whatnot. Someone that was interesting that you'd like to share with the audience.
Sarah. I already did. Should I do some more?
You got more?
Yeah, I got a lot more.
Bring it on.
Great. There's one. When you ask this question, one particular client comes to mind, and it's a client who was essentially sleeping a lot, depressed on a variety, on a psychiatric cocktail of medications, and had been feeling this way for quite some time, and been seeing therapists for quite some time as well. After our first two sessions, he stopped sleeping, stopped napping. He didn't stop sleeping. He stopped napping during the day, which was his problem, and he was starting to feel excited about life again. He said he felt moments of bliss that he hadn't felt since pre-adolescence, and for him, adolescence was somewhat of a traumatic, somewhat traumatic experience. One thing that he actually suggested that I share is that he also has quite a bit of anger, and will get very frustrated in a situation, say if he's angry at his wife, or say he's at the drugstore, and it's gotten very frustrating. He has this little rhyme he uses, and it's, "I see London, I see France, I see Sarah's underpants." And he said it just lightens the mood for him. He's like it helps him just be like, oh, okay, things aren't that bad. Let's just take things, like, let's just take things as they come. It's been really interesting experience with him. He's continuing to move forward. And we've accomplished a lot of his goals, such as tax forms that were 5 years old, that he had been trying to get to for quite some time and was unable to. And so we were able to set these goals and move forward. And he is also having sex with his wife again, which is another happy ending. This is not something really to get into here, but, you know, she started making an effort again since he was becoming alive again. She kind of lost interest. They lost interest in each other. But so I think that there's a way that naked therapy can help women as well, indirectly. But that's obviously a big topic.
I worked with a client who came to Salt Lake City for 2 weeks, and we did intensive therapy. And then I worked with her. She was in another state. I worked with her through Skype. And she was suffering from anxiety. She had a lot of childhood physical abuse and emotional neglect that she hadn't dealt with. So in those 2 weeks, we really did a lot of depth work and helped her to process some of the trauma. And then we followed up through Skype, and I found that to be really effective. She was able to effectively manage her anxiety and accomplish her goals, improved her marriage. I also did some marriage counseling with her, she and her husband, via Skype. And then they have family in the area where I practice, and so when they are in town, they'll come and do face-to-face sessions. But for me, I really enjoy the face-to-face, and I feel like that's kind of the gold standard. And then I like the online as an adjunct. And so that was a case that was really, really fun to work with.
I'm conflicted. I know that there are two really good clients that I want to address today, not just one. And I know one I should address and the other one I really want to address. So I probably address two, if you don't mind. Okay, I will. The first, initially when I got an email from John, "Hey, would you like to be on a panel about online therapy naked?" My first response, honestly, sincerely, was, "Nobody needs to see me naked." But then I started thinking about this client that I did see over the summer, and he was a Skype client that was referred to me, honestly, because he found me online and saw that I could do this. And he had been seeking something through the use of pornography online, where he had connected with a stripper and gotten to know her as a person a lot deeper than he thought he would, where he found himself actually paying just to talk to her. Sound familiar? So I said, oh, well, maybe there is something to this, because ultimately he came to seek me out, a non-stripper, a non-nudist. And we actually did a lot of really great work. He was in his 50s. He had just lost his parents. He lived at home. He did not work. And he was resentful that he had to pack up his parents' stuff and had to tolerate family members who wanted some of his parents' stuff and wanted to get involved in the way he wanted to do things. And he was able to process this over a couple of weeks, develop some confidence in the social skills he had, but that he had lost touch with, and then move on and establish his priorities for living his own life now, not as a caregiver, and emerging with a new identity. So this is an area where, you know, I think our two fields sort of overlapped, where the therapy that Sarah's proposing, had he been receiving it right away directly from the person he had consulted with, might have actually gone far. The second client that I wanted to talk about was an expatriated American who was living in Afghanistan. And she said to me, "You see this curtain behind me?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, there are two armed guards standing on the other side of the curtain. She said, don't worry about confidentiality. I'm not really sure if they speak English, but, you know, I'm okay with this as long as you're okay with this. If the sirens go off, I will have to vacate. And I went, okay. So I think there, you know, we were able to, she had consulted with me, honestly, because she was having some relationship issues with her husband, who she had met at another site, and they were communicating with each other through Skype and distance measures, and she had identified some themes of verbal abuse within their relationship and dominance and control. This is a couple that were leaving Skype on to each other throughout the evening into the morning, and you know, waking each other up, you know, online, having a complete online marriage during the time that they were apart. And she was trying to work up some stamina and maybe some skill sets to use to establish better boundaries with a partner. They were two really excellent cases that.
Thank you. And last question for this morning, and then we'll open up to any audience questions that there may be. Where do you see the future of your the kind of work that you're doing today online going? I mean, what might you be doing a couple years from now, or what do you think that the profession might embrace in a greater way?
That's another good question. I'm not sure what I'll be 3 years from now. I'm hoping that naked therapy is going to be more broadly accepted, more broadly known. I'm currently starting a new site, a new experiment that's called the Great Naked Experiment, in which I'm asking other people to join me to help basically create get some research and start the dialogue, get the dialogue going more about naked therapy. I am, you know, I'm very much open to collaborators. I'm still looking for people who might have ideas about where this can go. So yeah, I'm really open. And as I said earlier, I'm debating the direction for myself to go educationally as well. So email me. In 3 years. Or now.
I'm actually moving more towards psychoeducational, launching more webinars and e-courses. And as my clinic has grown, I'm doing fewer face-to-face clinical sessions anyway, moving more toward writing, blogging, those kind of things. And so, but we are launching this year an online arm to my site in Salt Lake City, so we're going to try that experiment. I consult with therapists around the country on building a successful private practice, so I do a lot of consultation via Skype and phone, which I think is a perfect modality for that, minimal risk. So I'm moving more toward education and training online.
I've been really developing my face-to-face practice tenfold in the last couple of years, and so I have that up and running. And right now I want to put more attention and emphasis on finding these emerging markets like the expatriated Americans who are in need of some clinical support, even brief, so that we can kind of tap into that as a resource, as a paying resource for the time that's involved in establishing this contact.
Okay, we'll take questions from the audience now. Just go to the microphone. Yep.
Hey, so
is it on?
No, I'll just talk about it.
Okay.
I'm Zach Giwa, Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Health and Hospitals in Louisiana. So, other than being duped by what I thought was a clever play on words, naked therapy.
We thought it was something
we
edgy by South By.
I did. I thought it was something to get the seats filled. So my interests tend to be more in the technology tools, and certainly I'm aware of psychotherapy and kind of the telehealth aspect of that, but I'm interested in kind of a few things, so I'll just spit them out and sit down and you guys can talk about them. But I'm interested in learning more about the technology, the tools that you use, whether they're pro or consumer type tools, you're recording, you know, I heard some Skype mentions, I heard some telephony mentions. So I'm interested in the tech tools that you use. What can we learn maybe more for Dr. Grohol What can we learn from psychotherapy in the physical medicine world and kind of the telehealth model? What are the barriers you foresee to online physical medicine therapy?
Yeah, let's
sessions and you guys, any of you guys, describe mental health? Yes.
So why don't we go down and people tell talk about the tools that they use?
Okay. Well, I think I gave a plug to Crypto Heaven, which is an encryption platform that allows me to have encrypted chat, encrypted email, and an encrypted file storage space. So that, I think, is the main tool that I'm using. And then I use Skype for video therapy because it is secure. And I use Purple Communications for my video phone because they were kind enough to grace me with a video phone telephone number. It's a huge nightmare if you're not deaf to get a video phone telephone number and not have to pass out an IP address to everybody. So the folks at Purple were fantastic, and I like their program. And my website is hosted by GoDaddy. The support there is fantastic. I use Website Tonight for my web development. I do it all by myself. It's a great hobby.
What's your website?
I have one that's dominant and the other one that's passive. It's www.audreyjung.com, real hard. And I also have www.mypsychservices.com if you want to take a look at the other people who are in my face-to-face clinic itself.
Julie?
I just use Skype, phone, and email. I'm not as involved, like I said, in that. But for blogging and content, I use all WordPress platforms for my website, so wasatchfamilytherapy.com and juliehanks.com. And I also blog for Psych Central. And then I could talk a lot more about social media tools, but I think that would be another conversation.
Julie, do you talk about clinical issues in email? Or
Generally not.
Because you just use regular email.
Yeah, but I mean, it's, you know, it's fairly secure. But then you talked about the high standard of online. It's like, mm-hmm. How many times have I left my file cabinet unlocked, yeah, or my door, you know? So there's risk. And I remember when cell phones, people were like, oh, well, so cell phones aren't safe, or fax machines. Anytime there's new technology, we tend to panic about confidentiality. And
Yep.
So mm-hmm. I tend to not panic about mm-hmm. it. Like, it'll...
Makes sense.
It's okay.
Sarah?
Yeah. Yeah, my website's sarahwhitetherapy.com, and I have a blog at nakedtherapy.org. I like MojoHost. That will be my plug. Their tech support's also fantastic, and I use WordPress. I use some Video Whisper software, which is through WordPress, for some chat, and then I also use Skype.
Great. The question about what the medical profession could learn from psychotherapy, and I think just in the mental health world in general, you're seeing the resurgence of the e-patient movement and the sharing of medical data with patients directly rather than going through their doctor. What they could learn is that in mental health, patients have been doing that for a very long time and taking a very proactive role in their own care, in the recovery movement. There's a very vocal group of people who, working with SAMHSA and other government agencies, have been very focused on empowerment and really help others through a peer-to-peer process and support groups and things like that understand that these conditions are not necessarily lifelong and that recovery is possible and that you can do it through the help of other patients. So. There's a huge takeaway for the medical community in the sense that a lot of patients feel isolated and they don't understand that there's a lot of support groups and a lot of technology now available to help them better understand their condition and get support for emotional support and information. So, one of your questions is about medication. None of us are medical doctors.
I can speak to that. I have a colleague who was practicing through FastPsych, which is a local online organization that has contracts within Arizona because her medical license is within Arizona, but they also have other contracts through the country where they are contracted to some of the more remote state-based programs to provide psychiatric or psychopharmacology. It's an interesting concept. If you contact those folks over there, they'll be able to detail for you what specifically they're using to ensure safety. But what she was basically doing is logging in, you know, at her site and then seeing a client who had presented at a clinic on a reservation or in a remote area. The clinic was staffed with nurses and nursing staff. During the course of the 20 minutes online, the psychiatrist or psychiatric nurse practitioner was able to determine what kind of psych meds need to be made. She would fax the scripts to the clinic or use a Medi program interface to call it right into the local pharmacy.
So someone there on site who was licensed to run the script?
No. The licensed professional was actually, you know, in her living room, you know, logging in online, and she was using her license to initiate the script. The people who were on site were actually just there to facilitate the clients through, yes, but also to make sure that if there were any major mental health breakdowns or difficulties, that they could be managed right away.
Great, thank you. One last question, sure.
All right. Hi, guys. I'm Nate. So sorry, I came in a little late, so if this question was already covered, just blow by. But it's actually a two-part question, and part of the reason that I ask is I'm involved in the virtual learning space. So we do it specifically with health and wellness, and so I'm interested in how much have you guys experimented in group environments of psychocounseling, and if so, what's been the biggest group you've done, and sort of what were the results like? And the second part of the question is, if you could connect to any group, any population across the states or across the world right now, that really is a need for your services virtually, what would that be? Would it be veterans, healthcare system, corporate wellness programs? Who would you most like to help if you had to pick certain groups? You mentioned expatriates, but I'm wondering what else you guys see out there.
So anyone do an online group?
Only in terms of you know, working with online students of mental health care who are interested in the practice of online and facilitating that cross communication, you know, through Moogle, I think it was, or some of it was Moodle, I don't remember what it's called. But so I presented basically at a couple of university classrooms, but that's it. I've never really facilitated a focal group psychotherapy online, and it would be an interesting experiment for me, I think. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of potential for that. I never have. Again, I do more psychoeducational and writing, blogging, but so through comments and those kind of things, I offer support or Q&As, but it's, you know, it's not considered group therapy by any means.
Yeah, I also have not worked with groups, but it's an interesting question in terms of what target group. I would actually really like to be working with more pornography addicts. I think that for some reason I'm not really reaching them. I'm not sure why, but I'm not.
Because they don't want to talk about their feelings.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. But that would be the group that I'd really love to start working with more. I guess more on an individual basis, not really in a group setting for them, but obviously. But they're the, yeah, I think that they could really, or I've worked with a few, but I would really like to work with more.
Yeah, one of my passions is helping women balance taking care of themselves and their relationships, because culturally women tend to take care of others first, and so that's really who I love to reach. And then again, the other private practice therapists who are isolated and who don't have an online presence, I like to consult and help them be able to really embrace technology and social media to build their practice.
I'm a generalist. I get bored. So I have specified areas that I work with face-to-face and online, but, you know, I like everybody. I like the nuances of a brand-new issue and presentation, so I can't really tell you, like, oh, I'm dying to work with vets. You know, I'd like to work with a few vets, and then I'd like to work with more police officers, and then I'd kind of like to work with a bored housewife or, you know, postpartum someone. You know, I just, across the board, I'm interested in it all.
Thank you so much for coming out today.
Thank you.